Lucas on Life.
Hello, welcome to Lucas on Life here on Premier Christian Radio. Over the last few weeks, we've been talking about how we can strengthen our local churches. And one way we can do that is with generosity. Let's face it, meanness is ugly. Grabbing is unattractive. Black Friday events are dark indeed, as the retail sector's excuse for a greed-fueled shopping frenzy sparks scuffles and scrums across the country. Determined ninja shoppers jump queues, elbow, shove, and even punch each other in their determined pursuit of alleged bargains. The spirit of Ebenezer Scrooge, the lead character in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, is alive and well on Black Friday. We don't have to be penny pinchers to qualify as being stingy. We only need to insist that most of our pennies and pounds are spent on us. Charles Dickens paints Scrooge, the wizened old skinflint, as a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. It's hardly a handsome portrait. But we don't have to wrestle with fellow shoppers to qualify as cheap. We've all been around people who work overtime to be last in line when it comes to paying. At the coffee shop, they open the door and insist that we go in first. But sometimes this is not out of courtesy, but it's a tactical manoeuvre ensuring that we get to the counter before them, and therefore we will be more likely to flash our credit card. Or at the end of a pleasant meal, their sudden departure to the bathroom is timed precisely to coincide with the arrival of the bill at the table. Returning from the loo relieved, their relief is heightened by the knowledge that we've paid in their absence, irritating especially when some veneer their meanness by making a virtue of it, insisting that they're thrifty, when in fact, they're just squeakily tight. All of this manipulative meanness not only takes a lot of effort, but actually robs us of the joy of generous giving. A recent sociological survey featured in the book The Paradox of Giving revealed that generosity is very good for us, and not in a silly tele-evangelist given God will make you rich kind of way. The meticulous research revealed that the more generous we are, the more happiness, health, and purpose in life we enjoy. Generosity not only blesses others, builds the church, but brings a smile to our own hearts too. And generosity, more importantly, changes the world. The early Christians profoundly impacted their culture with their generous lifestyles, even though most of them were poor. In their day, generosity was not widely valued. Roman society embraced a system called liberates. Simply put, the code went like this: you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It was a tidy arrangement unless you were poor and had nothing to give. Widows and orphans found themselves stranded at the bottom of the social food chain. In beautiful contrast, the early followers of Jesus gave their service, their money, their goods, their time, their safety, their creature comforts, and their reputations with a generosity that was not just a series of isolated, unusual actions, but was a way of life for them. They scattered good everywhere, freely and indiscriminately. They looked for sweaty feet to wash and even went further. When terrible plagues hit and huge swathes of the population fled the cities, abandoning the sick, the Christians often stayed behind, nursing the ill back to life, which meant that some of the carers died in the process. It's been said that we're most like God when we give. Those early believers didn't just share words and ideas about God, but they showed a confused, grabbing world what the giving God looks like. So, let's choose to live generously and not just with our stuff. If we do that, the local church will be strengthened. But let's embrace this attitude more widely. Let's give that stretch of tarmac to the bullish driver who rudely cuts in during the rush hour. Let's offer the rare gift of listening. And then instead of fuming over the man who stands in the five items only queue in the supermarket with eight items in his basket, let's smile and wish him a pleasant day. And let's not just believe in generosity, but think, plan, and act generously. Too many of us practice postdated generosity. One day we'll get around to giving, but we mistakenly think that until we do, believing in the idea is enough. It isn't. And if we're honest enough to admit a tendency to be tight, let's know that we can change. He's obviously a fictional character, but Ebenezer Scrooge changed. Dickens described the transformation. Many laughed to see this alteration in him, but he let them laugh and little heeded them. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. Come on, let's have a laugh. Let's be generous. As we consider how we can strengthen our local church communities, let's beware of prejudice. Sitting three rows back in an unyielding oak pew, I shifted restlessly. I was in unfamiliar territory, parked as I was in an Anglican church with high ceilings and higher theology. I loved the warm glow of the flickering candles and the unique scent that lingers in buildings that are nearly 1,000 years old. But this was unfamiliar territory to me, in a church that was stylistically a billion miles from my own worship expression of choice. You see, I come from the charismatic Pentecostal zone of Planet Church, where sung worship is loud, energetic, and frequently led by pre-adolescents who poured themselves into impossibly skinny jeans. Despite feeling like Methuselah in some of these high-octane gatherings, it's what I'm at home with. And so when the parish priest began the service with a parsonical droning voice that reminded me of a famous Mr. Bean sketch, I bristled. As the service continued, my mild irritation morphed into indignant anger. I have come to appreciate liturgy. Sometimes life renders us speechless, so to use the well-worn, life-tested words of others can be enormously helpful and can be a welcome reprieve from the carefully planned spontaneity of some charismatic gatherings. But now the vicar's voice went into full sing-song mode. I seethed. Why couldn't he just use his normal voice? Momentarily feeling guilty for my negative attitude, I quickly justified my inward tut-tutting by telling myself that my anger was righteous. My frustration came because of my passion that the church be relevant, but it was nothing of the sort. I was just being arrogant. Now it came time for the sermon, and I braced myself for what would surely be a hopefully brief homily of irrelevant twaddle. What happened next was shocking, because stunningly, the sermon was brilliant. Concise, colourful and relevant, it was a work of verbal art. But even more shocking was my response to the brilliant sermon. I hated it. It irked me because my foregone conclusions were so wrong. I so wanted to know that my judgment was right. You see, prejudice does that. It looks for confirmation that we are correct and blinds us to any contradiction that might show that our hypothesis about others is wrong. When someone acts consistently with our blinkered view of them, we gladly nod, happy to be proven right, if only to ourselves. And when they do something that is contrary to what we've decided about them, either we don't notice it, and if we do, we write it off as an irrelevant and out-of-character one-off aberration. And then prejudice can cause Christians to be very adept at using labelling machines. Someone steps up with a view or even a question that conflicts with our cherished convictions, and before even bothering to dialogue, we write them off by labelling them as being part of that group, and they're so wrong, which is inferior to our group because we're unfailingly right. Meaningful conversation is silenced, and we hunker down in the trenches of our own opinions. Jesus was a victim of this blinded thinking. Despite the miracles and wonders that he performed, some of the religious control freaks of his day didn't seem to notice them and were only interested in criticizing Jesus because they saw him as a threat. And when the miracles were just undeniable because chronically ill people were made whole or previously smelly dead people like Lazarus were suddenly alive and hungry for lunch, the only recourse for Jesus' critics was to insist that he was operating with dark powers. Back in that church, the priest with the parsonical voice had proved me wrong. Ashamed, I thought about apologizing to him, and then I decided that would be unhelpful. I've got a varied collection of bruises from Christians who have confessed to me. "Jeff, I've hated you for years," they say. "Well, I forgive them. Having unburdened themselves, they walked away relieved, leaving me depressed at the knowledge that I just didn't need. And so as we filed out of the church that day, receiving the customary vicarish handshake goodbye, I thanked the vicar, perhaps a little too enthusiastically, for his wonderful sermon. He smiled and wished me a good day, using his normal voice. But by then, thankfully, it didn't really matter which voice he used. It was a really odd conversation about another Christian leader who'd just been promoted to a position of national leadership. Cup of tea in hand, a fellow minister was holding court with a few friends, including me. He had some concerns about the man's suitability for the position, he said, his voice raised a little in earnest. But there was just one problem. He had no specific, tangible evidence for his hesitation. I'm not sure what it is about him, he mused. It's just that when he stands up to speak, although his preaching's fine, there's just something, I can't just put my finger on it, something that's not quite right about him. It's a very strong feeling that I have. Mark my words, guys, I think there might be a skeleton in that cupboard. And then, to endorse his unspecified suspicion, the minister added, and I'm not the only one who feels like that. There are a number of people around the country who think the same thing. Something dark is going to emerge, I'm sure of it. Brilliant. The newly promoted leader's character had been smeared, and all on the basis of a vague feeling. There was no evidence of anything being wrong, but suspicion had been raised and passed around simply because of a hunch. And for all I know, that hunch might have been created by jealousy or perhaps an altercation in the past that had never been resolved. We Christians have ingenious ways to hurt each other. Scripture tells us to be careful about bringing accusations about those in leadership. But surely an unwillingness to engage in sullying another person's character should apply to all people. It's wrong to create suspicion with vague spiritual nonsense. It's actually called gossip. Religious people frequently indulge in it, as Jesus discovered. The Pharisees, they were fastidious about what they viewed as sin. They refused to pluck a grey hair out on the Sabbath because that constituted work. They had mindless discussions about whether one could pray while up a tree, and even debated about whether bread baked by a naked baker was rendered unclean. But they were blinded to the rather more important sins that they indulged in. But gossip, it's as tempting as a Sunday roast. Scripture tells us that the words of a gossip are like choice morsels. They go down to the inmost part. You read it in Proverbs 18:8. Perhaps that's why rumour-mongering and negative whispering are such a problem in some churches, and for that matter, wherever human beings gather. There's such a perverse delight in hearing and sharing gossip, just as we thoroughly enjoy and relish every bite of an exquisitely prepared meal, so gossip is a rather delicious experience. Because of our mutterings, the person whose gifts and talents intimidate us is brought down to size and we feel better about our own inadequacies. Our hunger for scandal is satisfied, and then we're perceived as someone who is in the know, because we are privy to this inside information. And in sharing gossip, there's always the possibility that the conversation will unearth yet more negative news. During the Second World War, posters declared a stern warning about thoughtless chatter. Careless talk costs lives. A call to be diligent because enemy spies were on the lookout for secrets. But gossip is always potentially devastating, causing character assassination. Gossip is junk food. It leaves a lingering aftertaste because we know that we've been unjust and cowardly in our whispering. So, if we want to be those that build and bless, who strengthen our churches, when we're tempted to gossip, and surely that moment comes to us all, let's step away from that morsel. It will upset our stomachs and wound someone else's heart. Here's Bethel Music, Goodness of God. So we've come to the end of our series of programs as we've been reflecting about how we can build and strengthen our churches. all of us have the opportunity to influence things positively, but that takes intentionality. And during this evening's program, we've been thinking about generosity, not just believing in the idea, or worse still, post-dating, figuratively speaking, the check. Does anyone remember checks? We've also talked about the power of prejudice, where we like to believe what we believe, and if anybody does something that contradicts what we've decided about them, well, we just go ahead and edit it out. Often that kind of attitude leads us on to gossip. Of course, we Christians don't gossip, do we? No, we just share. We can even do that in the context of a prayer request. Please pray for Fred. He's struggling right now, which can suggest all kinds of things, particularly if we go into speculative details. Let's be people who this week decide we want our presence in our local churches to be a presence that brings blessing, strength, encouragement, empowerment. Jesus is building his church. It's the only organization on earth that he's promised to build. He'd like us to partner in his project. See you next week.
Lucas on Life.